Hey, can you guys still hear me?
Wait, Nancy?
Yeah,
I think we lost Scott.
Anyone still there? Shoot.
I see the spinning wheel of death. I'm trying to get it back.
Oh yeah, I see that.
Hold on, Scott, can you hear us?
Okay, we're back.
Oh, there he is.
All right.
This is fun.
So much fun.
Does that sound familiar to anyone? I know a lot of people are also using video apps to try and connect right now. And so is a mock version of Congress.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to this congressional continuity exercise.
Sort of. I mean, they're trying to.
We now move to...
I object.
Mr. Esterling is recognized. Mr. Esterling, please.
And all this connectivity stuff brings me to what we're talking about on the show today. And that's the possibility of remote meetings in a place that is famous so far for rejecting them, for everything being in person, on paper, formal. And that's the United States Congress.
Everybody's going to try to keep their character, but it will be bumpy, and you will see lots of things that somebody should have thought of and nobody has thought of before. This is the opportunity to think of those things.
Oh, and by the way, I'm your host, Scott Bland, and this is Politico's Nerdcast. Senior tech reporter Nancy Scola.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Is here to talk to us about how the coronavirus has forced Congress to look into issues like remote voting, remote meetings, remote proceedings in a way that they really haven't since September 11th, 2001. Nancy, your great piece for Politico magazine asks, why on earth Congress doesn't already have systems for legislating remotely? Even last week, they were crowding together in these rooms in the Capitol at the same time as government officials at every level, including them, are telling people to keep away from each other. And it turns out people have been asking this question for a long time and mostly getting ignored.
Yeah.
How did you come to the idea of doing this piece? Obviously, coronavirus was a big impetus, but this is something you've been thinking about for a while before that, it sounds like.
Yeah, I have been. So I was actually a staffer. You know, my previous career was as a congressional staffer myself. And I was in Capitol Hill, on Capitol Hill on September 11th. And I remember running screaming from the building. I wasn't screaming, I promise you. But other people were screaming, running from the building. That was a really kind of terrifying, informative experience at whatever I was, you know, in my 20s, whatever it was. And so I've had an interest in thinking through some of these questions about, oh my gosh, we're stuffing all these legislators and staffers into one building, and maybe that's not the smartest way of going about this. So I've thought about that for some time. And then there's another incident that we mentioned in the piece that happened about 3 years later, where the airplane of the governor of Kentucky, the governor was traveling to D.C. to go to the funeral of Ronald Reagan, started drifting towards Washington airspace. No one knew what it was. There was miscommunication about the plane. There was some talk about perhaps shooting it down. And they evacuated the Capitol again. I was in the building again. And again, we ran screaming from the building. And I remember thinking at the time, this is 3 years later. We're no better at this, what we do in Congress is actually physically under threat than we were on September 11th. So that really sparked my interest in thinking through some of these questions.
And it turns out people have been asking this question for a long time and mostly getting ignored.
Yeah.
You opened up your story on September 11th because that was really a wake-up call for some members of Congress about the way the body operates and the vulnerabilities about it. And the impetus for your piece is really how coronavirus has been another wake-up call 20 years later.
Yeah, so the piece was sparked by this discussion that's been going around for the last couple of weeks about remote voting, right? This very specific question of, hey, in the time when Congress is in this sort of dealing with this coronavirus crisis, why doesn't Congress have the capacity to remote vote? And it occurred to me that voting is like just one of the things that Congress does, right? It's sort of the cherry on the sundae at the end of the day when you've done all the hard work of legislating already. So I started thinking about how would you actually move not just like voting, the voting process that Congress goes through, to the internet, to sort of a virtual ecosystem, but moving everything that Congress does online. And we're starting to revive that discussion because of this coronavirus situation.
And now enter Brian Baird.
This is one of the things that we hope will never, ever be needed with all our heart.
But if it is ever needed, there may well be few things that we do in our lives that are more important than having accomplished a responsible and constitutionally valid mechanism for continuity.
As a former congressman who has been just beating the drum on this issue forever, probably saying, "I told you so," right now to any of his former colleagues who will listen to him, and is still, even in retirement, right in the middle of this fight.
Yeah, so Congressman Baird was in office on September 11th. He was in his second term in Congress. He's a clinical psychologist from Washington State. And on September 11th, he was watching the news like we all were at the time, saw the planes crash into the World Trade Center, told his staff to keep an eye out the window to look for anything suspicious happening outside the Capitol itself. Pretty soon after that, we saw the Pentagon being struck. I was in the building at the time. I remember it well. We saw the Pentagon being struck. He got his team together, his office, the staff in his office together, and said, "Okay, we need to go floor to floor evacuating folks from this building." This was before Capitol Police told us to get the heck out of there. So he helped evacuate the Capitol on that day. Almost immediately after, he started thinking through some of these continuity questions. What do you do about protecting a Congress when it is so physically vulnerable?
And I mean, he's had a lot of trouble getting people to take this seriously. It's, you know, when I saw your story come out, as I was clicking on it, I remember thinking, it's like, oh man, I really hope she talked to Brian Baird. Because as it turns out, when I was spending my first summer in DC as an intern, I interviewed Baird when he was in Congress and he had just finished testifying about a constitutional amendment he was proposing to address some of these continuity of government issues.
Oh, funny.
And he was so angry afterwards because almost no one showed up to the hearing.
Yeah.
Some of the folks who did show up weren't taking it seriously. And he was just so, so pissed. It made a huge impression on me. And I remember writing a story and he said that, you know, it was impossible to get members of Congress to grapple with their own mortality.
Yeah.
We've been talking a lot about congressional ego on the podcast in the last few weeks. And now we're talking 20 years later. This issue is back.
Yeah. He told me this story that I included in the piece about when he was trying to generate interest, to gin up interest on this topic. He went to a veteran, sort of senior Democratic member of the caucus and said, "You know, so-and-so, we don't have a plan for what happens if a bunch of us die in some sort of mass casualty situation." And the member of Congress said something like, "What do I care? I'll be dead by then."
Oof.
Yeah.
Has the current coronavirus crisis sparked anything, you know, among current members in terms of more interest in remote voting? Has there been any movement toward that at all, or has it really not gone anywhere?
It was interesting to me because I kind of went into it thinking, you know, I focus on technology mostly.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking this is a technology problem, right? This is about Congress is just for generations been terrible at adopting new technologies, right? That's just the thing that's known about Congress. It's something I've experienced about being in Congress. And I kind of assumed it was just a technical problem. And then when you start digging into it, it becomes kind of fascinating that there's also all these legal aspects, right? People raise this idea that maybe the Constitution precludes Congress meeting in a place that's not the Capitol. But really, it's the political discussion around this that factors in most strongly, right? Why congressional leadership doesn't want to have their members participating in Congress outside of DC is really a political question about what it does to the balance of power, what it does to power within Congress. So that was really interesting for me to realize, okay, this is, maybe it shouldn't be surprising because this is Washington, but realizing that this was really a political question more than a technology one was kind of just really fun for me to uncover while I was reporting this out.
Yeah, you mean like, you know, in terms of basically leadership and committee chairs trying to exert their influence and being more able to do it in person, or were there other factors as well?
Yeah, so one of it is that one example a staffer gave me was this idea that members going to and from the floor to vote is a chance for leadership to buttonhole them and to persuade them to support a measure or not support a measure, all those sorts of good stuff. And leadership has also, so that's one factor, right, is the persuasive ability of leadership, one of the strongest tools they have in their toolbox. It becomes weaker if you don't have members to actually physically accost in Washington, D.C. There's also this discussion of we are supposed to be the balance of power against the president of the United States, right? This is the checks and balance system, and we are supposed to provide that counterbalance, all the more important in the age of Trump, at least on the Democratic caucus side of things. And they think if members leave Washington, they're not going to be the story anymore. They're not going to have the sort of profile that they would have had if every member was in D.C., and they're just really reluctant to do it. So that's sort of like the contemporary political question. There's also people, there's one line of thinking that is that leadership does not want to set up remote voting or remote legislating capacity because members at some point are going to fear for their lives enough that they're not going to come back to Washington. They're going to go home to their districts and sort of hole up there. And that leaves, you know, Speaker Pelosi, Leader Schumer, Leader McConnell in D.C. is the three people left as this like ruling group in Washington making all the decisions. So when I say it's political, I don't, when I talk to people involved in this process for a long time, it's not necessarily that the politics shake out in any clear way. There's a number of political considerations and leadership has said, you know what, this is just too complicated. We're going to punt on the question. But they've actively weighed these in ways that I was surprised to find. So I talked to this Senate staffer who worked on the Continuity of Government Commission after September 11th. He worked on it for more than a decade. And he said, oh, yeah, leadership is very much thinking about what does it do to our political power if we allow remote voting to move forward. So it's not sort of a, you know, a passive decision. They actively have made the decision not to allow this to happen for reasons that, yeah, shake down to politics.
Well, so in the meantime, you know, some of these advocates you wrote about in your piece tried to hold a demonstration to kind of show off that a remote Congress could work, like a big Zoom meeting. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this was sort of the moment when I knew I had a story. I heard from some of the folks working on this topic, some of the advocates and activists, that they were going to put together this Zoom call.
So today around here, there's a mix of staffers, political scientists, friends of Congress. We also have a Politico reporter and a representative from C-SPAN. One of the big questions is how this would work for public access to proceedings if Congress decides to do something virtually.
Basically demo the ability to do a congressional hearing and a bill markup using Zoom, which is the platform that we've all sort of embraced in recent weeks to do these kind of video conferences.
So with that, I have now got my singing Buddhist bowl instead of a gavel, and I will gavel this committee to session. I actually wish we started our hearings that way.
And so I got to watch that. Brian Baird participated from his home. He lives just north of Seattle.
We're going to have some fun. We'll make some mistakes, but the topic is about as serious as it could possibly get.
He was co-chaired by Bob Inglis, who is a congressman from South Carolina. And you had a former House parliamentarian call in from Bethesda, Maryland, folks participating in Kansas, sort of all over the country. And they just kind of went through the process of, could you actually do what a hearing and a markup looks like in real life, could you do it on a Zoom conference call? One of the organizers admitted, Marcy Harris, who's a former congressional staffer who's worked on this stuff for a long time, she said, you know, it was utter chaos, she admitted.
And Charles, I'm so sorry. I am going to mute you again. Just
Marcy, let's ask everyone else to mute theirs.
But it was just kind of the first step of figuring out, okay, what could this feel like in cyberspace? How would this actually work? They had a number of questions about not just, you know, like anybody else, they had technical issues, right?
I'm going to mute everybody for now just because there's a little bit of background noise.
Someone was homeschooling in the background. You could overhear that.
Oh, we have a guest behind you. That's fun to see.
this is a 13-year-old doing distance learning in a car.
I've got some 15-year-olds behind me hidden away.
But they had a number of questions of, you know, one of the things that came up was they did a voice vote.
All in favor say aye, please.
Aye.
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 It appears to the chair that the ayes have it. All those opposed say no.
No.
It appears to the chair that the ayes have it. The motion is, hang on just a sec. Yes, the motion is carried. The committee wishes to raise a resolution
for an amendment, one of the proposals that was under consideration. And somebody later admitted, I voted both yes and no on that because I knew I wasn't on screen. And so how do you deal with that in sort of one of these real-time virtual hearings? The parliamentarian and other folks raised the issue about how does a parliamentarian or even a congressional staffer offer their member guidance on how to vote or how to, you know, sort of not how to vote, but the next step in the process, right? How these things kind of, the nuts and bolts of how these things work. But it was just a way of kind of demonstrating that this isn't impossible. It would take some work to figure it out and that it's something worth putting more time and thinking into.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, where do you think it's going from here? Do you think any of these practices are really ever going to stand a chance of being implemented?
I have to, history would suggest it's not going anywhere, right? Like September 11th was a pretty big wake up call for the country in a lot of ways, including this congressional continuity question. It hasn't gone anywhere since then. I think the only hope might be that some of these younger members who really grew up using the internet for all sorts of really consequential things say, this is just absolutely insane, and I refuse to participate in a body that doesn't at least have some option for me to engage in remotely. So if you see the caucus really start demanding it of leadership, I could see it potentially changing. But, you know, as we all know about Congress, they pick things up when it's, a hot topic in the moment, and they'll drop it pretty quickly. So if I had to bet, I wouldn't think that we're going to see much in the way of remote participation in Congress anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, you put in your story, there are some really crazy stories throughout congressional history of the lengths members go to show up in person, sometimes risking their own health, their own lives. There's a Bob Packwood, right?
Yeah, so there's a great story about Senator Packwood, Senator from Oregon, who was carried in feet first by Capitol Police to the Senate floor so that they would guarantee a quorum. And he was arrested first, which was just sort of terrific to kind of picture that moment.
Why were they carrying him in?
They needed, it's sort of the twists and turns of Congress, they needed a quorum on something, and Democrats thought that Republicans were thwarting their ability to have a quorum by simply not showing up. I'll be honest with you, I did not understand entirely the procedure behind it, but Democrats just demanded that he be physically present on the Senate floor. So, Capitol Police carried him in. The Washington Post has a great story about it from at the time, and they said he was carried in feet first, which is just sort of a beautiful picture.
Yeah, that's an arresting image, no pun intended.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we also included there Ted Kennedy showed up, when he was pretty ill with brain cancer, showed up on the Senate floor to vote on healthcare legislation. John McCain did the same thing when he was also ill with brain cancer.
Thinking about what that member of Congress told Baird when pressed about this issue, why would I care,
yeah.
Right? And to your point about, kind of pessimism about this, some of the stuff ever happening, I wonder if it would take something like coronavirus really having taken hold within Congress when they were all together last week.
Yeah. We did see five members, I think, are already infected, which is not a ridiculously small portion of a population that's only 535 members. So you would think maybe that would wake folks up, but it doesn't seem to have done so yet.
Yeah, maybe not during this current crisis, but I wonder if people are going to start thinking about that after.
Yeah.
For a straight up or down vote, it's a lot easier to imagine than for any number of other things, right? And I think the way you described that Zoom meeting that they had really cast some of that in a different light. And again, it's not just the kind of personal interactions that you miss with something like Zoom, right? Of talking to another member, crafting, meeting to craft a bill, whatever. It's like getting the advice from the parliamentarian, the voice votes, all sorts of other stuff about the way Congress works. It requires some kind of teasing out. At the same time, it really does seem crazy that there's no way for them to handle the situation without packing into these rooms that are really not all that big.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems like, I think in my mind too, the strongest argument for them doing this in some routine way on even, instead of the having members fly in on Monday nights to take one vote, doing that remotely is that, as we've all seen, if people work remotely at some point during their normal day-to-day lives, they're kind of better able to move to work from home in a crisis situation like this. So if they kind of develop those muscles, it seems like they could roll it out, when they absolutely have to. So I could see them kind of at the margins experimenting with this, and kind of at least they have that tool in their toolbox when they actually can't physically be in the Capitol.
That's a good point. And it would certainly save money on those last minute plane flights and maybe even the congressional pants budget.
What is the congressional pants budget?
Oh, no, I'm just, they're all on Zoom, right? It's
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, no, absolutely. And, the fly-ins, the Monday night fly-ins to take one vote is one of the things that members say they find most annoying about being a member of Congress. So I know we're kind of extrapolating pretty wildly here, but the idea that if it makes it just less annoying to be a member of Congress, if you can participate remotely, maybe you get better people wanting to do the job or wanting to stick with doing the job after, more than a couple terms.
Another good point. We'll have to see what happens. Nancy, thank you so much for walking us through it. That was great.
Thank you, Scott.
And before we let you go this week, I want to talk through a few stories on Politico.com that I think Nerdcast listeners will be especially interested in. I'm guessing a lot of you are following the news really closely right now, but there's so much of it and so much specifically about coronavirus and what's happening, it's easy to miss a few big developments in politics. So one of those is that our colleagues Natasha Kurecki and Zach Montalaro have done a lot of writing over the past week about some real anger in Wisconsin about the fact that they still have elections scheduled for Tuesday. That's April 7th. And some there are blaming Democratic Governor Tony Evers for not pushing harder to delay the vote. They say it's incompatible with public health to be holding an election next week. But Evers says that he's been in a bind since, in addition to a presidential primary, there's state and local offices on the ballot. Supreme Court justice for the state, Milwaukee mayor, all that sort of stuff. And not just the presidential primary that people are going to be voting on. So, tough situation there. That election is on Tuesday. David Siders also wrote about how the nation is suddenly getting interested in governors again. It's been 20 years since either party nominated a sitting governor for president. Mitt Romney in 2012 was a former, but he also spent a great deal of that campaign not talking about his record. But governors are on the front lines of the coronavirus response, citizens are taking notice, and David reported that that's already upended a lot of the assumptions and conventional wisdom that people who think about this sort of thing have had about the 2024 presidential election. And one more thing, this is a story we've been expecting for a long time, but my colleagues Alex Thompson and Mark Caputo wrote about it on Thursday. The Democratic Convention has officially been delayed a month from mid-July to mid-August, and we'll see if that gives the party enough time to get past the coronavirus pandemic, though it's definitely possible that Democrats and Republicans will have to scale down and dramatically alter the conventions this summer, depending on how the fight against the virus goes. They might be turning to Zoom as well, who knows? All right, that's our show. Our producer is Annie Reese, our senior producer is Jenny Ahmed, and our executive producer is Irene Noguchi. Our illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. Once again, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again next week. Did that sound good, Sammy? Yeah, that was good. Do you want to say anything into the microphone before I turn off the recorder?
Goo-goo. That's it.
Okay.